We're very pleased to have Dr. James Crippen, current professor at Cal State Fullerton, speak to us on existentialism and the modern age. Many modern notions of reality and meaning seem timeless to us, but have actually emerged quite recently. The rapid advance of science in the 18th century supplanted metaphysics. James will help us understand the rise of existentialist philosophy and how it is interacting with religion based on a metaphysical God.
Well, I want to thank everyone for welcoming here, and Mary for the nice introduction. Because of the heat, I'm not wearing the requisite all-black attire that many people associate with existentialism. But I'm not sure I'm a full-blown existentialist, so I don't know if I can defend it completely, although I have quite a bit of sympathy. I'll talk about my associations with it as well today. Basically, I'm going to have three parts to my talk to hopefully clarify things. The first one is I'm going to go a little bit into the origins of existentialism and where they came from, where the existentialists come from, rather. The definition, kind of a general definition of existentialism, which is nearly impossible since every existentialist has their own definition, and probably most of them reject that title altogether. They don't want anything to do with it. And three, I'm going to talk about the general relevance of it today. How's it still, even though a lot of people have declared it dead? As far back as 1950, there was an article that said, is existentialism living or dead? So it's, of course, a lot of people think it is, but I'll make the case that there's still much alive in it. So I'll start off with a few misconceptions. A lot of people have heard of existentialism. Existentialist philosophers have an image of them. And one of the biggest misconceptions is that it's a type of nihilism. And nihilism simply means the belief that there's no meaning at all in existence, that existence has no meaning whatsoever. What we'll see is they're actually a reaction to nihilism, and that they actually find existence to be very meaningful, but not in the traditional way, or the way traditional philosophers might have seen it. And of course, it's understandable that they're seen as really depressing figures with titles such as Nausea or The Sickness Unto Death. Those are books you know might be uncomfortable having on your shelves. Many people think that they're atheists or that they're all atheists. It's true that there are many atheist existentialists, but because existentialism is so individualistic, there's also many existentialists that choose to be religious, so there are religious. So the origins, well, the most concrete origins go back to the 19th century and Germany especially, which was, of course, going through a lot of changes. And German philosophy, so you have to have a little bit of a background in German philosophy. I'll give you a real rough breakdown of the two main German philosophers that are relevant here, and then the two first two existentialists who were kind of lone thinkers, lone wolves, who didn't have any followers and were kind of forgotten during their time, and then revived in the 20th century. So it definitely didn't start off as a group movement. It started off with individual lone thinkers. So the first big, impetus for existentialism was the philosopher Hegel. And if anyone's ever heard of Hegel, he was one of the biggest and most final systematizers of philosophy. At the very beginning of the 19th century, he had this grand system where he encompassed all of reality, or what we call metaphysics, and all of history, into what he called a reawakening of consciousness of the world spirit. Now, this isn't just one person. For him, consciousness was all consciousness together, what he called the world spirit, or in German, Geist, which is slowly realizing itself through history. And each individual is just sort of like a pawn or a cog in the wheel of that. Even someone like Napoleon, he would say, was not someone that was really out there consciously doing. He was actually sort of a tool of the world spirit as well. So what this does, though, is, of course, for any of us that read this, and of course 19th century people that were reading this would think, some of them really liked it, of course, but one thing that it puts us in this position where, what do I do? What about me? What about my life? Okay, that's great that I'm this vehicle of history. And so this was the starting point for a very lonely philosopher from Denmark. His name is Søren Kierkegaard, and he's considered the very first existentialist, although he never founded a movement. He died pretty much in obscurity. He wrote very obscure books that weren't even written in his own name, and most of them were in kind of a novel form. So what makes him existential? Well, for him, the most important question was, simply put, human existence. So that obviously is kind of a key to existentialism, and also the individual. He thought, okay, he'd read Hegel, and he thought, yeah, Hegel is this brilliant systematizer, and again, he represents like the culmination of 2,000 years of philosophy looking for this grand system what we call a metaphysical system that would basically explain all of reality. Well, he thought that that leaves out one thing. At the very end, after all of Hegel's systematizing, it leaves out the individual experience. So Kierkegaard felt, I still have to live my life. Maybe that's true that I'm like a pawn of all these forces, or I'm cogging this wheel, but I still have to make choices in my life, and I have that feeling of making these choices, and this commitment to these choices are very important. Now, Kierkegaard didn't like groups, and he wrote against what he called Christendom. Not against being a Christian, because he was a Christian, he was always a Christian. It's very interesting. So the first existentialism was very religious and always remained a Christian. For him, though, he rejected the church and was very critical of what he called churchgoers, people that just kind of went to church. And so for him, he decided it was up to the individual. And so for him, religion meant this very personal commitment to God. And he wrote books like Fear and Trembling, where he talks about this very lonely personal commitment. He died fairly young. I've already surpassed his age at death, I've come to realize. He was 41, so and very, again, died alone. His works, we'll find out later, become this great inspiration for existentialism as a more of what would be close to a movement in the 20th century. So there's our first beginning, again, this individualism. The second beginning is the atheistic side. So you have one of each in the 19th century. And this is more influenced by a second German philosopher who also was a great systematizer, just like Hegel, except he hated Hegel. His name was Schopenhauer. And he actually was the closest we have to a nihilist. He was a pessimistic philosopher, very pessimistic. He thought that basically the only thing we're here to live and reproduce and die, and that what he called the will, which was the ultimate reality, didn't care about us as individuals. Again, we just sort of used us to reproduce and die, and the next generation and the species keep populating. That's true of the whole animal kingdom, and we're part of that. And our basic role in life is to suffer for the most part, he said. And so along comes another philosopher who gets kind of a bad name because he's thought of as a nihilist. His name was Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche had read Schopenhauer, and he took Schopenhauer very seriously. He thought, you're right. No one gave us reality. No God just gave us reality. And by this time, we're in the middle of the 19th century, and we're losing a sense of God. And Nietzsche, of course, famously said, at this point, God is dead. He talks about it a number of times. But, of course, he meant this in the sense that the faith that was holding people together for so long was starting to whittle away. It became more of an option not to believe. People didn't have that strong belief they did throughout the Middle Ages, and even up through the Enlightenment. So in the 19th century, we have our first atheistic philosophers, even though a lot of philosophers before had basically questioned the idea that we're an Earth-centered universe. They still held on to some idea of God. And here you have one of the first philosophers to really say, no, there's no God. Nietzsche agrees with that, but he doesn't, like Schopenhauer, want to throw away the meaning. But he does echo Schopenhauer. In one of his first books, it's very much a tribute to Schopenhauer, but also breaking away from Schopenhauer, he talks about the myth of Salinas. It's a very famous story that echoes Schopenhauer's philosophy. It's a Greek myth that talks about Salinas, who was a companion of the god Dionysus, and he was looking for the meaning of life. So he finds, he goes out and he finds Dionysus, something like that. I might be altering it a little bit, but never mind, you get the point. And he asks him, what is the meaning of life? And he says, oh, you don't want to know, you don't want to know. And basically it comes out and says, but I'll tell you. He says, the meaning of life is never to have been born, never to have existed at all. And the next best thing is to die as soon as possible. So a very negative thing. But Nietzsche, of course, rejects that. He wants to get away from that. He wants to find meaning. So what is his response? Nietzsche doesn't just stick with that and say, you're right, then because, yeah, we're going to die, then life is, in fact, meaningless. He says that you can find meaning, but again, the meaning is going to come down to the individual. And I have a quote from Nietzsche. I'll read, so it'll be crazy. He's just a quick little quote. Nietzsche writes the following. Genuine, that is what I call him who goes into God-forsaken deserts and is broken, his venerating heart, free from the happiness of serfs, redeemed from gods and worship, fearless and fearful, great and solitary. That is how the will of the genuine man is. So for him, it's kind of an act of will, breaking from conventions, finding meaning, and also for yourself. So meaning is found for yourself. And Nietzsche had a very interesting way of testing this meaning. Very famous and often, well, misunderstood or interpreted in many ways, theory, I guess you can call it, called the eternal recurrence. And I'll present this to you, as Nietzsche did, as, again, a test for me. So the idea is, yes, there is meaning, but you're going to have to find it. And it's actually harder than it seems, because it's, he believed you shouldn't go along with the herd or the crowd. You had to find it on your own. So it took quite an act of courage. So very much like Kierkegaard, but here you see for him meaning doesn't have anything to do with religion or God. Kierkegaard found God. Nietzsche does not. But he still finds that there's meaning in your life itself. So he says the following. He says, imagine one night you awake to find a demon standing by your bed. And the demon says, I will tell you your fate. Remember, the earlier fate was more of the Schopenhauer one, just die. This one is a little different. The demon says, this is the meaning of life. So there is meaning. What is it? He says, well, the meaning of life is that you will live your life over and again, again and again, for eternity, in exactly the same way you've lived it, with no changes happening. So everything that happens, for example, the words that I'm saying right now, everything you've ever done. And this might sound good at first. You think, wow, I get to go through all these fun things. That vacation in Hawaii was great. I get to do that again. But, of course, then you think, well, there's also those really bad moments, those terrible things that happen. Do I have to go through those again? The answer for him is yes, because every little thing, every tiny thing makes you who you are. And so his question is, what would you answer, yes or no? Now, as a teacher, I always ask this question to my students, and I always get mixed results, and they're only 18 years old. It's like, well, wait, we have more to come. And a lot of them are saying no already. So that's such how hard the test is. That's kind of a little disturbing, I suppose. Basically, to sum up the origins parts here, how does this present a break from the general tradition? Of course, philosophers never agree with each other, and tradition goes back 2,000 years of philosophy. One break is the philosophers really focus on objective truth. And now we have some philosophers talking about a personal meaning that seems to be forgotten in all the systems that have been built over 2,000 years. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the systems. The systems are fine, just like mathematics is fine. But there's something that it leaves out, that is our condition as individuals having to make choices. So there's the heart of existentialism. So, and the most recent tradition is the modern tradition, after the medieval tradition. A quick history of philosophy there. And that starts from René Descartes going up to Hegel, as I mentioned before, the great systematizer. And for them, basically always objective truth and a strong system was important to have figured out in order to unlock the keys to reality. So Descartes famously said, cogito ergo sum. You may have heard of this translated as, I think, therefore I am. The most famous sayings in philosophy ever. The existentialists would, if you wanted to have them do that, reverse that into sum ergo cogito. I am, therefore I think. So basically we start off, we're existing beings in the world, and then we start to figure things out. And this is going to lead us to the best definition, I think, that I can present here. But before that, I'll mention a few things about my own experience, how I started off with this. Those were my earliest interests in philosophy. Well, I've moved on and become interested in widened my horizons. One of my first interests in philosophy was as a student at Sonoma State University back in the late 80s, early 90s, quite a while ago for me. So, Ben, that was at the very beginning. And when you're younger, this is a philosophy that really grasps you. And I've since expanded things. I do believe that existentialism alone isn't enough. But I think it is something that still has something relevant, so that's why I'm talking about it here. And we have some great philosophers that studied existentialists, although you can never really fully be a follower of an existentialist. They always resist followers. People like Nietzsche didn't want a follower. The idea is to, on your own, create your own meaning in your own life. So to say I'm a Nietzschean really is someone that doesn't want followers to try to follow him doesn't work very well. Sonoma State was, when I was going there, was sort of a small island of continental thought, which is what the existentialists are part of, and kind of the vast ocean of analytic philosophy, which dominates philosophy in this country, which I'm very interested in as well. Also, when I was in college, I had a growing interest in jazz music, and there's always that mystique of the jazz music and the cafe and existentialism. I think there's a great connection to our church here as well, the Unitarians. We started off by rejecting a dogma of the Trinity. And that, of course, is rejecting dogmas, what existentialists are about. And, of course, one of the most famous Unitarians, Ralph Waldo Emerson, himself was a contemporary of these guys in the 19th century. And Nietzsche was one of the few Americans that, of course, he looked down on American writers in general, but he was one of the few American writers that he actually admired. And you can see why when you read this. I'll read a little clip from Emerson just to bring it into our church here. There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better or for worse as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil bestowed in that plot of ground which is given him to till. So here we've got the American farmer, sort of existentialist, making it on his own and sort of rejecting conventions. So let's jump into the 20th century now. And again, these are the two lone figures of the 19th century. And in the 20th century, it becomes as close to a movement as it can be. It has its rise and fall in the 20th century. And we'll also come up with, again, a nice clear definition of it. Well, first of all, it starts in human subjective experience. The starting point is by looking inward. But unlike, as I mentioned, Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." So he was looking inward, but he's looking inward for an objective universal structure, which he finds. The existentialists don't look for an objective structure. For them, each one of us is going to find something different. Now, one thing is when we look inward, we find we're faced with our lives, we're faced with our death. And this comes to one of the most famous ideas in existentialism. It's the idea of anxiety, or as the Germans would say, angst. And angst is hard to translate, or anxiety is too. It's not a fear of something, like a fear of speaking in public. It's more of a fear of nothing, really. It's that angst or anxiety is a fear that they say you have just in the face of nothing, just kind of the realization that here we are existing with nothingness surrounding us. And it becomes, of course, it's a weird question, but it is a fundamental existential question. And so most famous existentialist probably you may have heard of is Jean-Paul Sartre, and a lot of people associate existentialism more with the French than with the Germans, even though really the origins come more from Germany. And that's because he popularized it. He wrote novels and plays and things that people could read more easily, as opposed to the Germans, not so easy to read. And of course, so he gives us that image of the French philosopher sitting in a cafe, smoking his pipe, doing his philosophy. And that's what he did, but it's not what every existentialist would do, of course. And so here we have Sartre, and he was brilliant at, again, simplifying it in a way that most of us can understand. It was something the Germans had a lot of trouble with, especially Heidegger. We'll talk about briefly next. Basically, the fundamental formulation of existentialism is existence precedes essence, if you want a saying for them. That's it right there. What does this mean? Well, basically, it's also a reaction to the tradition. Essence means, in this sense, purpose. So you have something like a watch, let's say. Now, a watch, Aristotle, let's go back to Aristotle. He, of course, was the king of finding purposes. He thought everything had a purpose. A watch is pretty clear. Someone made the watch for a purpose. We know what it's for, to tell time. And you can look at other things, a chair, eyeglasses, and so on, and you find that they all are made for a purpose. Well, Aristotle actually thought that human beings were here for a purpose, too. And so was everything in nature. But in the modern period, we get away from the idea that things are there for a purpose, that they're sort of a result of deterministic causes. And so what that puts the position to us is, well, we are a little different. We exist first, and then our purpose comes along. So it's not that we don't have a purpose. Hence, it's not nihilistic, but we have to create a purpose. We find a purpose. And how do we do that? Very simply, Sartre says, through what you do. And so the idea that people, when someone says, well, life is meaningless, his answer would be, well, what are you doing? You're living. First of all, you're choosing to live. They're really sometimes, they're a little harsh sometimes. Camus, the famous existential French novelist, actually put it in a really kind of little heavy terms. He said, every morning you make the decision, should I commit suicide or drink a cup of coffee? So I know that's really harsh, but what his point is, you're deciding to do something, like what you do. And so that everyone, in fact, everyone has a meaning in life, and it comes down to what you do. So then, of course, it becomes individualized. And for this reason, Sartre thought we were free. He thought, so the essence of this existence we have is freedom. In fact, he even said it's so extreme that we're condemned to be free. That's one thing we don't have a choice about, is our own freedom. So he believed that we have choice. Even if you're in terrible circumstances, you still have some kind of choice. And he was writing a lot of this stuff during the war, and he thought when France was occupied by the Germans, and they had to always make choice. He said even things we said was a choice. So it actually made us even more existential. And so, of course, with choice comes responsibility. So because we have freedom of choice, we're also responsible for who we become, according to Sartre. Now, his was very individualistic, at least the earlier Sartre. But Sartre didn't just come up with this. A lot of the stuff he got was taken from the second philosopher who actually preceded Sartre, and that is the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. Now, of course, he's pretty much unreadable. You have to learn. He even invents his own German. So I'll say a little bit about his ideas. He kind of invents his own words, and he thought Sartre misunderstood him completely. But at least Sartre is somewhat understandable. But Heidegger is very important because he really does come up with the formulation of 20th century existentialism, that fundamentally we are being in the world, in der Weltsein. So being in the world, so we find ourselves, philosophers, another thing, if you read philosophy, you'll read traditional philosophers, they'll start talking about objects in the world and start to explain them what they're made up of and things like that. And they'll say, well, there's this object here, there's a watch over here, there's a book over here. But Heidegger says that's secondary. Fundamentally, we're already engaged in the world. We're already involved in activities. And only later, philosophers kind of come later and then start thinking about things. But that's not the way the world really is. The world's not really a separate thing for us. It's something we're completely engaged in. And Heidegger calls this engagement ready to hand. That's fundamentally, so the way we're fundamentally in the world is we're a part of the world. So there's this, of course, if you read or take a philosophy class, you'll always get, how do I know that I exist, or how do I know that what I see is real? Well, Heidegger says, well, we start off with actually behaving in that way and acting in that way, and that's the fundamental way we are in the world. So that question is kind of a fake question. It's an artificial question. If there's a real problem, then it would come up. He used the example of a hammer. When you're using a hammer, you're fully engaged, you're not thinking about the hammer as something separate. The hammer is actually part of your arm at that point. It's part of your activity. When the hammer breaks, then it becomes an object separate from you. I use the example, especially with my students, a good example is driving a stick shift car. If you start driving a stick shift car at first, right, it's a little difficult, right, you're jumping around a little bit. But once you get to, after a while, you're driving it, you don't think about it anymore. Right? It's actually a part of your body. You don't think, like, oh, I have to put my hand here, I have to put the clutch in. You don't think about that anymore. It's all part of your ready-to-hand. But when, let's say, the car breaks down, then you have to think about it as something separate. Then it is what he calls present at hand, so sort of as an object for you. So he brings us down to this more fundamental level of engagement in the world, whereas philosophers before start with, here I am, and there's the world, as if the world is something else. Go read Descartes, and even going back to Aristotle, they still talk about sort of the world and object. He talks about it as we are in the world, already in the world. He makes that point. This brings us to some relevance today. So this question is, we're always forgetting this. And one thing that happens is, as we're engaged, we forget about, for him, the fundamental question of existence, or what he calls being. Being with a capital B. That is the fact that there is anything. And if you step back, this, of course, is a very weird question to ask. But he asks it, and he thinks it's the most important question. The question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Think about that. At one time, your life might think, why is there a world at all rather than just nothingness? And it's very difficult to answer, if not impossible. And so when he looks at being, he said, well, the interesting thing about us is humans, although he wants to get away from the word humans because he thinks that's too much baggage already, like biological baggage or metaphysical baggage. But he can talk about us, which he calls beings in the world. And we're what he calls Dasein, which is a German word, which kind of means being there. In other words, we're the only beings as opposed to an object, like a clock or a table or something like that. We're the only beings for whom being is itself an issue, that we think about being. So he calls us the custodians of being. So how is all this stuff relevant to today? So there's some of the basics of what existentialism is. Well, Heidegger had a big problem with technology. And, of course, you can see why, living at the time that he did in the 20th century. And a lot of other existentialists did. Carl Jaspers did as well. And, of course, we see this rapid advancement of technology following the Industrial Revolution, following the Scientific Revolution. But now we have this in the 20th century, of course, we know what the consequences of that. Now, of course, technology is a means of controlling nature. That's true. But, of course, what we've seen, and if this is something that's still going on today, we've had even more advances in the computer revolution in the last 30 or 40 years. It also ends up controlling and alienating the individual. And that, of course, is what the existentialist's big concern was, the individual. Now, Heidegger was a very conservative guy, kind of a reactionary guy. But he believed that technology has driven us away from this question of being. In a lot of ways it has. We get so caught up in technological things is that it can start to control us. Think about the more gadgets we have, the more we have to worry about fixing and maintaining them, the more apps we can get now, and just on and on and on and on. And so Heidegger was seeing this, again, 60, 70 years ago. And there's a sense of horror that comes with this as well, coming up with the German idea. This brings a sense of horror. Kind of that there are dark consequences of technology too. There's a pro and a con. So, technology can produce a Frankenstein monster to come back and bite us. For example, we have chemical fertilization, which helps produce agriculture, but it also leaches into streams and causes pollution. And another thing we see is existentialists have seen, or they saw happening again at their peak, which kind of peaked out by the 1950s. That social science was also following this model of mechanistic sciences, and of course it's even more so today in even the social sciences, psychology, that the mind and the person is just suddenly getting swept up along with molecules. We can find out about neurophysiology and genetics, and that's pretty much going to answer the question and explain that individual. So more and more we're seeing this idea of freedom just not even looked at. But that doesn't take away, an existentialist would say, well, that doesn't take away the fact that I still am experiencing the world as someone who has to make choices in the world. And as early as 1949, again, very relevant to this idea of the relevance of existentialism, scientist Norbert Wiener, who actually wrote the book and I think coined the term cybernetics, because he saw very early on what computers were possibly going to do. And this was in 1949. He wrote, "The first stage of the technological revolution is the devaluation of the human arm as a source of physical power." Well, that's true. It's obviously, and there's a benefit to that, but also it's taking away a lot of things that humans did. The second stage is it threatens to devalue the human brain, at least in the simpler and more routine decisions. And, of course, it does that. It does a lot of things for us that our brains used to do. Now, this doesn't have to be a bad thing, obviously. Heidegger thought it was really bad. Now, Heidegger ends up right before his death finally saying, after everything that had happened, he had a very questionable life story. He was involved with the Nazi Party for a while, and then he obviously was kicked out of it, and there's a lot of concern about that, which is relevant. But he finally ends up saying, at the very end, it was on the cover of Der Spiegel magazine, 1976, it was published right after his death. It said, "Only a God can save us now." So he just thought, this was it, we've lost it, or technology has made us into these cogs, and we've lost the sense of being, and what philosophers would say, the sense of wonder at the very beginning. But, of course, that doesn't have to be the case. There also is a possibility, you can't throw away technology, it obviously does shape us, but you also can look at it intelligently, and that's, I think, where I would kind of leave this, saying, yes, it's possible, and that, of course, just would open up questions. Now, existentialists don't come up with, and speaking about existentialism, they don't just come up with answers. It's not a doctrine. It's sort of a way of opening questions, which philosophy generally does. So if you look for an answer, well, here's a way to solve this problem. Usually it doesn't, but sometimes opening up questions is the most important thing to do. Things that people just haven't thought about, bringing these issues up. Now, it was when I was in grad school I started to pursue more of these more complex questions. That is where I saw the role of history in society having an effect on the individual as opposed to some of the most basic, or Sartre at his most extreme, is just the individual is completely free. He even eventually concedes that, of course, we are part of society and a part of history, and that is something we need to be aware of. So the individual is not isolated. So, and there's nothing that about that idea that contradicts existentialism. I do find that it's relevant also just through my own experience of teaching introductory students every year, and they still grasp it. If something is not engaging the students, I throw it out. I don't bother with it anymore. So if it weren't, I wouldn't talk about it. But there's something about these questions that can always be opened up, right? Everybody at some time, and I don't think it's a question you ever have to get rid of. I think As a UU member, I noticed that these existential questions remain alive. We still haven't given up on opening up questions. And, of course, today, we see there's a lot of new technology. We have new generation. Cell phones are something that, again, can be looked at in this question of technology. Internet information overload, these are all questions that can be asked. So existentialists would probably say, yeah, let's ask them. But there's, of course, always that idea. There's not going to be one simple answer, that each individual is going to have to approach it. So although, yes, in the academia it has died out, there aren't a lot of people that focus on existentialism anymore, although we always have a course in it, and it's always a good thing to teach people and introduce people to. Is it relevant? Well, for a group like the existentialists who tend not to believe in absolutes, although it's a tough question, although, of course, anyone that says there are no absolutes is making an absolute statement. So I'll just say, is it relevant? Absolutely, yes. All right, well, thank you for having me. And I don't know if we have time for questions. Or... Okay, the question was then, in contrast to earlier philosophies, like pre-17th century philosophies, where it was basically given by God, you interpret the scriptures, and you've got the answer, although there's debate and interpretation, but not the fact that that's where you got the truth. Is how did they, and so I take it that's the idea, why did they come up with this, or how did it come about? And the answer, of course, then you have to go to, obviously, even though they're individualistic, as I said, an individual is never completely separated from history, and it could only come up at a certain historical time period. This is clear. So as individuals as they were, it's not like someone could just pop up and come up with this idea. There's something about the times that led to that. And so I would point to just a few things. Obviously, the scientific revolution all the way through the Enlightenment, which it wasn't like an overnight thing. Someone just came up and said this. And Kierkegaard didn't just come out of nowhere as well. Hegel actually anticipated the idea that someone would feel kind of alienated from his system. But then, of course, what did he do is he explained it through his system, what that person was going through. So in a way, he explained Kierkegaard away, but Kierkegaard didn't really accept that. So it did come up in some ways as a result of all these historical circumstances and the Industrial Revolution and also just the loosening. It was a gradual loosening of religion. The grip didn't go away right away. We, you know, go back to right the 16th century, and you have philosophers who are starting to be able to question God, but they'll still bring God right back in. They're still into science, but they had God as like the watchmaker still. And then it wasn't until that by the end of the 18th century, you had philosophers that would come out and openly be atheistic, like David Hume. And earlier it was Thomas Hobbes was as well. In fact, something was in the air that would open this. Of course, they did it in a funny way. Hobbes would say, well, I'm not saying God doesn't exist. I'm just saying it doesn't have anything to do with philosophy. So let's not talk about it. And then Hume waited until he was dead, until his writings that God didn't exist was published, another safe thing to do. And so by the time we get to the 19th century, we have people like Schopenhauer who came out and just completely didn't believe in God or anything else. So I would point to this, the historical circumstances of that time led to that idea amongst philosophers that, yes, we have a problem here and we have to find meaning, so that you got these early philosophers. And of course, there were other things that happened as well. And by the 20th century, something about the events of the 20th century led to that. And you can point to the wars and the increase in technology. And also, it does sort of become a movement because you have these little seeds. It's impossible to know everything that starts these things, but they would have an answer along those lines, what started it. And in philosophy, the other question is, what's the validity of it? You know, how relevant is it? And that's, in a way, a different question. There's a more of a historical question. And the other question was, well, that's how a lot of philosophers will say, well, that's how it arose, but what's the, truth of that? So, okay, that's a good question Jim asked there. So, the question was, first of all, what's the meaning of life? So I could give a number of answers on that, a glib one or an existential one, maybe my own, which would probably still be existential. Well, that would probably still be still existential, because the existential would say, yeah, it's, there's no one existentialism. So then I could probably answer that. And then well-being and happiness. Well, that's a good question. I'll start with the well-being and happiness and maybe try to move back, see if I can get some answer that's coherent. That's actually very Aristotelian, which is fine. It's actually a good one. Aristotle is probably the most brilliant philosopher to ever live, and he said, yeah, happiness is the end of life. That's what everyone seeks, happiness, and well-being is included in happiness. Happiness for him was not just feeling good. It was much, much more. So it's a great answer, I think, and I would agree to it to some extent, depending on where we, because then it asks the question, what's going to make you happy? So happiness doesn't really, if I would answer, yeah, people seek happiness, I would say, yeah, but then how are you going to do that? How are you going to get well-being and happiness? If I just said, you know, today I'm going to be happy today. And then you're going to say, well, okay, well, what are you doing today? I said, I'm just going to be happy. Or are you going to watch a movie? Are you going to spend time with your family? No, I'm just going to be happy. See, it doesn't answer the question. So I asked the further question, what makes happiness? So I would go along with the happiness, yes. And of course, then it comes down, then it becomes existential again, because different people have different ideas. Aristotle thought there was one way to be happy, but you know, because he was very much of an objectivist who thought that you had to do certain things to be happy, and that's it. Mainly reason. He thought human reasoning was the pinnacle of what we could do. You can't be happy without reasoning. Now, of course, the idea of happiness, when we get to this period where I was talking about, it sort of dies out. The Germans never really been interested in happiness. They're not into happiness. Not at all. Look at the German philosophers. Nietzsche said, right, only the Englishman wants happiness, because the English have a tradition of happiness, and they don't. So I would still go along with you, and so I would say yes, as an existential answer, meaning for me would be pursuing certain, so I would just go and talk about what I'm doing right now, doing philosophy and playing music, and that's right there. I can answer that for myself right there. There's the meaning of life, but that would be existential for me. For everybody, well, you can do something general like Aristotle, so I'd like that answer. All right, I think, there's a lot loaded in that question there. Thanks for the question, though. As first you talked about, something along the globalization of knowledge, perhaps, and how, and I'll say something about that. I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but something about the condition of people in different parts of the world. I will say, first of all, it obviously, in many ways, existentialism is a luxury. It's for people that have that, just like Aristotelianism as well, that you have to have certain needs met. I agree with that. And it's not meant to be a universal philosophy. And yeah, there are other needs that people have. Those need to be met before you can have the luxury of having all the, and the smorgasbord of choices, as you mentioned. I think that was the first part of it, along those lines. Yes, we do have that. And I like to think that I'm helping people be aware, because I always tell students the stories that I have when I lived a life through college without a cell phone. Didn't have to have one at all, of course. They kind of understand that. And a lot of times I do get them understanding that, yes, sometimes simplifying certain parts of your life can be good, and technology can be good, but there's a downside to it. So I'd like to think that I'm making them aware of that. I fall into that too. You get on the internet and you're just going, and pretty soon you're kind of lost in it, and you're kind of moving away from, kind of wasting a little bit of time there. So yes, I think I am. And then I think the other part of your question was something about hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the study, is like the science of interpretation. That was actually Hans-Georg Gadamer, you mentioned, and Paul Ricoeur were students of Heidegger's, that's one of the reasons why, despite his kind of dark past there, his flirtation with Nazism, he had a lot of students that really recovered him that were not at all in that, and said, well, there's something about his philosophy that was great, even though he, as a person, he had some failings. But, hermeneutics is something that also doesn't get much attention anymore. Perhaps it should, not in at least not in philosophy so much. It's sort of moved towards what they call literary criticism. It has more of a, but I do think it's important, because it's basically a study of interpretation of meaning, I think it's somewhat still relevant.